Are you ready? Are you ready?
We're ready. We're ready. Yeah, we're ready. 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 We're ready. We're ready. Yeah, we're ready. 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 We're ready for the
California, land of fantasy and make-believe. It's Sabino Veritas. Featuring host, writer, humorist, experiential mystic, raconteur, and parallel parking expert, Tom Sabino. Now, here he is with Sabino Veritas in Wine the Truth, Tom Sabino.
Hello, Sabino Veritas listeners, Sabino Veritas fans. Thank you for joining us again this Thursday evening and every Thursday evening, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Eastern time, and all the international times in between. And of course, 24/7 on juicedtalk.com. Today we're going to have part two of the interview with Mark Cohn, who wrote the book, the biography of Alan Sherman, Overweight Sensation. So let's get right to it. Part two of Alan Sherman's Overweight Sensation with Mark Cohn. Odetta. From the 1960s.
Kool-Aid. don't bring me a malted, and don't bring me champagne. I'll tell you what, boy, bring me one scotch and soda. Then you'll take back the scotch, boy, and leave the 2 cents plain. Seltzer, boy, when are you coming? If you don't bring that seltzer, I'm gonna tell Mr. Meltzer on you. Seltzer boy. That's better. Could you put in a little chocolate sauce?
Let's rejoin Mark Holland in his talk about Alan Sherman and his connections with Hollywood.
He says, here's an homage to Alan Sherman. And then the great Jason Alexander, who played George on Seinfeld, gave me a wonderful blurb from my book about how great Alan Sherman was. So there you have David, Seinfeld, and Alexander, three of the five major characters and creators of the great, great Seinfeld show, all agreeing on the greatness of Alan Sherman. So what you find when you scrape a little bit, when you dig a little bit, is that Sherman's influence on the generation that's creating or has created today's great comedy is very, very well known. One of the most wonderful things that happened to me with the publication of my book is that the Coen brothers, the filmmakers, Joel and Ethan Coen, were interviewed on Terry Gross's show Fresh Air on NPR, and they were discussing their new movie Inside Llewyn Davis. They were discussing the novelty song, Please, Mr. Kennedy, Don't Shoot Me Into Outer Space. And the novelty song led to a discussion of Alan Sherman, because it was a time of novelty songs with Alan Sherman. And both Joel and Ethan Coen were relating to Terry how much they loved Alan Sherman growing up.
It's music from the soundtrack of Inside Llewyn Davis. And my guests are Joel and Ethan Coen, who wrote and directed the film. Now, since that's meant to be a novelty song, it made me think of what were the big novelty songs of that period. And one thing I remembered is like Alan Sherman's big hit album, My Son the Folk Singer, which was kind of like satires from a Jewish perspective with a lot of like Yiddish jokes in it. That was a hit in 1962, a year after This Is Made. Yeah. And you had referred to Alan Sherman in our previous interview when talking about the character of Cy Abelman in A Serious Man.
Well, I was going to actually, you know, when you asked about what part folk music played in our lives earlier on in the interview, I was going to mention Alan Sherman because we had Alan Sherman records when we were kids. And you're right. In fact, we just recently did a concert in New York with all of our actors in the movie who sang in the movie, and a lot of the musicians who worked on the music in the movie, and then lots of other people who were singing sort of old American folk songs and more contemporary music. And Gillian Welsh and Dave Rollins were involved in that, and it's always been a subject of sort of an interesting thing between the two of us and Dave, that he also used to listen to Alan Sherman when he was a kid, which I find very amusing.
But yeah, that was an early folk influence. My Son the Folk Singer, which I can picture vividly still, the album cover, and My Son the Nut, which was also a great album cover. And I think it was My Son the Nut that had Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, right?
Yeah, that was the one where he was buried up to his neck
in nuts. Yeah. Somebody just put out a biography of Alan Sherman called Overweight Sensation.
Really?
Which I'm anxious to read. Yeah, I haven't gotten it yet, but yes.
How many volumes?
His influence is out there. It's very widespread. It's very important. So many people that create the comedy that we love today have Alan Sherman in their bones, in the back of their minds. It's informing what they think is funny.
I do a lot of parodies, it dawned on me, actually I saw, there was a tweet from the person who introduced us, Mark, I forgot his name now, I'm sorry.
Jonathan,
yeah, because he has the Twitter account for Alan Sherman, and I said, oh my God, Alan Sherman, and realized how influenced I am from Alan Sherman. I mean, he's been a tremendous influence on me.
Why'd I send you out? Tell me, were you worth it to share and to give? Why'd I send you out when you have to shout? Selfie, will we see?
Please follow me on Twitter at TJ Savino, at TJ Savino, at TJ Savino, Twitter. And we're going to be back with Mark Cohen and his talk about Alan Sherman. His book is The Overweight Sensation about Alan Sherman. We'll be back with him in a minute after these words.
Mo. Through
an exclusive arrangement with Urgin Yeshe, Tibetan divination expert. Savino Veritas listeners may have their tough questions answered. Through the universal synchronicity of Manjushri, seer of all past, present, and future, Urgin Yeshe reads your questions and throws the dice for you. More importantly, he'll answer your questions based on Manjushri's guidance, which Yeshe will invoke for your reading. The price? $22. Submit $22 to PayPal and one well-thought-out question to tjsavino22@gmail.com.
Should I go to college or not?
What's the best way to advertise my business?
Can I trust my boyfriend to be faithful?
What's the best month for the wedding, May or June?
Will I ever get pregnant?
Who's the best candidate to fill a supervisor's job? May I count on my best pitcher to win this game?
How much should I gamble at the casino?
Do I need to go see the doctor about this condition?
Is Atlanta the right place for me to move?
Should we increase our homeowner's insurance?
If I get the job, will it help our relationship?
Will marital therapy keep us together?
Where should I look for my lost ring?
Will I ever find it? Can I?
Can I?
Should he?
Should he?
Will they?
Will they?
When will?
Will.
Can.
Questions.
Questions. Money.
Love.
French enemies. Mo.
Mo.
Mo. Tibetan divination. Savino Veritas listeners, right now you can get two questions answered for $22 and one for $11. So for $11, you can get a very vital question answered through the synchronicity of Manjushri and the universe as interpreted by Tibetan yogi Urgin Yeshe. Just write out the questions, send them to tjsavino@22.com. tjsavino22.com. That's $11 for one, $22 for two. We know a lot of you are skeptical. Give it a try. If you're not satisfied, we will refund your money. If you are not satisfied with the answers that were given by Urgin Yeshe, we will refund your money. So take a chance. $11 for one question answer, $22 for two. At tjsavino22@gmail.com. You're listening to Savino Veritas.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
It's the fabulous game show.
All tied up, ready.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards.
Welcome to
JuiceTalk.com.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth. This is Artist D.
And Anne Marie from Up All Night on 4 Culture Radio.
Have you got any wine, Anne Marie?
I'm completely intoxicated.
We love to wine. We drink wine. We listen to Savino Veritas every week at JuiceTalk.com. Don't we love Tom?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
And I was insanely into Steve Allen when I was growing up, and he was often on the Steve Allen show too.
Yeah, after his fame, well, he and Steve knew one another from the early days of television, and Sherman even briefly worked as a producer on one of Steve Allen's shows in early 1962. So anyway, we were talking about the timeline in Sherman's life. So he was singing all these homemade Jewish parodies of the Broadway musical to his friends in New York in the mid to late 50s. He had gone through changes in his producing career. He left or was fired, I should say more accurately, from I've Got a Secret. He went out to California where he had another TV producing job. He lost that job. And he continued singing his Golden Moments from Broadway parodies out in California and Hollywood, LA area for his new group of show business oriented friends. And it was there that in a house that Sherman rented briefly during the summer of, I believe it was 1960, I'd have to double check my book, either the summer of 60 or the summer of 61, he rented a house that was next door to the home that Harpo Marx rented during the summer to get out of the heat of his Palm Desert or Palm Springs home. Mm-hmm. Harpo lived in the desert year-round, but in the summer, he escaped the desert heat with a home in L.A., and he lived next door to Alan Sherman, or Sherman, I should say, lived next door to him. And they got to know one another, and Harpo learned that he was writing these Jewish song parodies, and Harpo invited Sherman to house parties that Harpo held at his home. And of course, a man with the comedic and showbiz stature of Harpo Marx had for guests at his home the cream of the crop of Jewish Hollywood comedy. He had some of his brothers, of course. He had George Burns. He had Jack Benny. He had a whole group of people. As Harpo Marx's son said to me, they had the whole group from, oh, darn, there's a famous Jewish country club that's still around today, but was especially important in the early 60s in Hollywood when there were still Jewish and non-Jewish country clubs. I'm forgetting the name. And anyway, Sherman performed his songs at Harpo's house for this group of people, and they went bananas over it. And little by little, word seeped out until word reached a man named Joe Smith, who was an executive at Warner Brothers Records. And Joe Smith gave Sherman his first contract, and they recorded that first album, My Son the Folk Singer, in August of 62. They could not record and release the Golden Moments from Broadway because all of those songs, of course, were protected by copyright. And even if the owners of the songs would grant permission to have their songs parodied, which of course they would never do, certainly not in the way Sherman was parodying them, it would have cost a fortune to obtain the rights. So the idea was to parody songs that were in the public domain. And that's what led to folk songs.
Here's to the crab grass, here's to the mortgage and fat, here's to suburbia.
Lay down your briefcase, far from the rat race, where nothing can disturb ya.
Uncomplicated, it's what we waited for.
arranging of folk songs, which by definition were in the public domain.
Yes, yeah.
Although Sherman made a mistake in one or two cases, he parodied Waterboy, which was a song, it's a traditional kind of black work or prison song that was made famous in the very early 1960s by a fabulous female black folk singer named Odetta. And Sherman parodied it and turned it into Seltzer Boy. That's also on My Son the Folk Singer, another one of those great Jewish parodies. It turned out to be owned by someone, and there was a copyright on it. So money had to be paid later on. But that's what influenced the decision. That's how the direction became to turn in the direction of folk songs. And the album became this unexpected, enormous, enormous hit.
Veritas Do-Over.
Seltzer Boy. Where are you hiding? If you don't come right now, I'm gonna tell you, boss, on you. Don't bring me water. I gotta have seltzer. 'Cause water don't bubble, and water don't fizz. Water, I hate it, 'cause it ain't carbonated. But a glass of seltzer, on the other hand, is. Don't bring me Pepsi. Don't bring me a Kool-Aid. Don't bring me a malted. Champagne. I'll tell you what, boy. Bring me one scotch and soda. Then you'll take back the scotch, boy, and leave the 2 cents plain. Seltzer Boy, when are you coming? If you don't bring that seltzer, I'm gonna tell Mr. Meltzer on you. Seltzer Boy. That's better. Could you put in a little chocolate sauce?
And Sherman quickly followed up. The album was released in mid-October. By the end of December, there was album number 2, My Son the Celebrity. You have two albums appearing within about 2.5 months of each other, which is kind of extraordinary, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Mid-October to mid-November, from mid-November to the end of December. That's 2 months, you know, and it took a couple of weeks for them to understand it would be such a big hit. So basically, the decision had to be made to cut a new album, write a new album, and record a new album, and release a new album in about 6 or 7 weeks. It was an amazing turnaround, and Sherman produced another very, very, very good album, and probably the greatest, most brilliant song on the album is his parody of the Jewish folk song, Hava Nagila.
Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila, oh, the day they met. Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila, no one will forget. Harvey's a CPA, he works for IBM. He went to MIT and got his PhD. Sheila's a girl I know at BBDNO. She works the PBX and makes out the checks. Then came one great day when Harvey took the elevator. Sheila got in 2 floors later. Soon they both felt they were falling. Everyone heard Sheila calling, ring the bell, but they fell. Harve and Sheila fell in love. Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila chose a wedding ring. Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila married in the spring. She shopped at A&P, he bought a used MG. They sat and watched TV on their RCA. Borrowed from HFC, bought some AT&T, and on election day worked for JFK. Then they went and got a charge of plate from R.H. Macy, bought a lay at Pink and Lacey. Then they had twin baby girls, both with dimples, both with curls, one named B, one named K. Soon they joined the PTA. Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila moved to West LA. Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila flew TWA. They bought a house one day, financed by FHA. It had a swimming pool full of H2O. Traded their used MG for a new XKE. Switched to the GOP, that's the way things go. Oh, that Harvey, he was really smart. He used his noodle. Sheila bought a white French poodle. Went to Europe with a visa. Harvey's rich, they say that he's a VIP. This could be only in the USA.
Here, we really should talk about this Jewish influence and where it came from.
Yes, please.
Because Sherman's decision, Sherman's hunger to create a public Jewish American voice through song and comedy was not based on the fact that his parents were had surrounded him with this kind of desire or world. In fact, it was precisely the opposite. What Sherman was very keen to understand very keenly understood, I should say, was that his parents detested their own Jewish backgrounds. It was an enormous problem for them. And his parents led such chaotic lives that the irony of their lives was, and particularly his mother, that in their strenuous desire to become fully and wholly American, his mother, by the way, always insisted that she was born in Chicago. She was not. She immigrated to this country as a six-year-old child, and that was clearly known to her. Her first language was Yiddish. She grew up speaking Yiddish in Eastern Europe. She was a little girl, the age of a first grader, when she came here. It wasn't something lost in the shrouds of being a 10-month-old. Mm-hmm. But his mother always insisted she was born here. One of the things that happened, because his parents married over and over again, trying to lead this perfect American life, was that they were not able to raise their own son. Their lives were too chaotic. They moved too often. They remarried too often. So Sherman's mother lodged her son, Alan, with her parents. So Sherman spent an enormous amount of his childhood with his Jewish immigrant grandparents, exactly the world that his mother was desperate to leave behind. And the great irony was that Sherman, during his stays with his immigrant Jewish grandparents, he absorbed and came to love what his mother was determined to abandon and forget. And Sherman's later Jewish comedy served him two very personal projects and desires. One was to pay homage to the grandparents he loved so dearly. The other was to reject his parents' determination to assimilate. And he also understood that the pain his parents were feeling, the embarrassment they were feeling, was a problem that he thought he could solve. He wanted to make a new blend. He wanted to create something which in 1962, and certainly in the mid-50s when he was writing his Golden Moments songs, had not yet fully existed, and that was a Jewish-American identity. There were Jews, everyone who knew in the Jewish community who those people were. Those were the people who spoke with Yiddish accents, who were born overseas, who always felt like foreigners in America. And then there were their American-born children who went to American public schools, who were American kids, very, very much.
That, you know, what you're speaking of now, have you ever seen, Mark, that movie? It's called Avalon, I think.
Yes, Avalon is a very good film.
And it reminds me of this, how the different generations fit in or don't in the American culture.
Man, I recently decided to count among my friends. Last night, won an Academy Award for a song that I think is nice. I think is beautiful. And which I decided to desecrate. And my trouble is that from all this vamp, I can't figure out what key it's in. That's it. Chop liver. Rolled up in a ball. Too much cholesterol. They say. You heartbreaker. You fat maker. From now on, I'm going
the safflower way. You made me wider than a mile. Oh, you and your beguiling smell. Tis time that I bid you goodbye. Your calories are high, like Huckleberry pie. Chopped liver, farewell. That's short notice.
So Sherman was doing in the 50s with his comedy what was being done in a quote-unquote high culture by novelists such as Saul Bellow with his great novel, The Adventures of Augie March, and then in the late 50s with Goodbye Columbus from Philip Roth, and many, many other writers as well, Herman Wouk. They were creating the idea of the Jewish American, someone who was wholly American, but also was an ethnic type, and that there was no need to surrender ethnic identity, become American, or vice versa. You didn't have to surrender your American identity, which you felt you fully inhabited and had an absolute right to, and you didn't have to jettison the Jewish side of yourself, which you had grown up with, which your parents fully inhabited. But this was not a given in the 1950s. It was still something to be worked out. And Sherman was among those who was working it out. And it was a very, very important project to him. You know, that line that he would introduce the Golden Moments, what would have happened if all the Broadway musicals had been written by Jews, which they were, is his thesis, his uncovering of the Jewish American contribution to American culture that was an underground movement. Mm-hmm. These contributions to American culture were not considered Jewish contributions. They were not identified as contributions from American Jews. They were just American culture. It would not be until much, much later that it became a commonplace. Today, it's certainly a cliche that all the great Broadway musicals were created by Jews, and there are PBS specials about the great Broadway musical, The Jewish Contribution. I'm garbling the name, but this is today a common idea. It wasn't a common idea 60 years ago.
Oy, my Zelda, my Zelda. My Zelda, she took the money and ran with the tailor. Once again now, my Zelda. My Zelda. My Zelda, she took the money and ran with the tailor. My Zelda, she found her big romance when I broke the zipper in my pants. My Zelda, she took the money and ran with the tailor. Everybody!
My Zelda.
Now. It's almost too sad to tell to you. She took 7 books of green stamps too. My Zelda, she took the money and ran with the tailor. Everybody! Once again now.
My Zelda, my Zelda.
That tailor, he really hurt my pride. He made my lapels an inch too wide. My Zelda, she took the money and ran with the tailor. Everybody! Again now. Members of Hadassah. Everybody. Oh, why did she go and fall in love? I haven't seen her since Tisha B'Av. My Zelda, she took the money and ran with the tailor. Everybody! My Zelda. My Zelda, she took the money and ran with the tailor. Sing a little soft. The doctor was looking at the x-ray, and I asked him, "What do you see?" And he kept on looking at the x-ray, as he said in French to me, "I see bones. I see gizzards and bones, and a few kidney stones. Among the lovely bones, I see hips and 14 paper clips, 3 asparagus tips. Among the lovely bones, I see things in your peritoneum that belong in the British Museum. I see your spine, and your spine looks divine. It's exactly like mine. Now doesn't that seem strange? And in case you use pay telephones, there's $2 in change among your lovely bones. Oh, hello there, nurse.
Zeba, Zeba.
Come over here and look at this x-ray.
Zeba, Zeba.
It's really remarkable.
Zeba,
look at this.
Zeba, Zeba.
Isn't the lumbar vertebrae supposed to be connected to the clavicle?
Zeba.
Well, I know, but it's scotch tape.
Zeba, Zeba.
Hey, look what's in there.
Zeba,
look at that. It's a stamp. It's a 1922 Zeba, McKinley Ultramarine Blue.
Zeba.
With imperfect perforations. I've got to get that out and put it in my collection. Look in there, there's printing. What does it say in there? U.S. Certified Grade A. Look at this, it's fascinating. See those little round things? You know what those are? Those are M&Ms. Those people are right. They don't melt. Among the lovely bones.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a Japanese transistor radio.
On the second day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
green polka dot pajamas
and a Japanese transistor radio.
It's a Nakashima.
On the third day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
a calendar book with the name of my insurance man.
Green polka dot pajamas and a Japanese transistor radio.
It's the Mark IV model. That's the one that's discontinued.
On the fourth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
a simulated alligator wallet.
And a Japanese transistor radio.
And it comes in a leatherette case with holes in it, so you could listen right through the case.
On the fifth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
a statue of a lady with a clock where her stomach ought to be.
A simulated alligator wallet, a calendar book with the name of my insurance man.
Me, polka dot pajamas,
and a Japanese transistor radio.
And it has a wire with a thing on one end that you could stick in your ear and a thing on the other end that you can't stick anywhere because it's bent.
On the sixth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
a hammered aluminum nutcracker and all that other stuff.
And a Japanese transistor radio. On the seventh day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
a pink satin pillow that says San Diego with fringe all around it and all that other stuff.
And a Japanese transistor radio. On the eighth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
an indoor plastic bird bath.
All that other stuff.
And a Japanese transistor radio.
On the ninth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
a pair of teakwood shower clocks.
And a Japanese transistor radio. On the tenth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
a chromium combination manicure scissors and cigarette lighter.
And a Japanese transistor radio. On the 11th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
an automatic vegetable slicer that works when you see it on television, but not when you get it home.
And a Japanese transistor radio.
On the 12th day of Christmas, although it may seem strange, on the 12th day of Christmas, I'm going to exchange an automatic vegetable slicer that works when you see it on television, but not when you get it home.
Chromium combination manager, scissors and cigarette lighter.
A pair of teakwood shower clocks.
Indoor plastic bird bath.
A pink satin pillow that says San Diego with fringe all around it.
Hammered aluminum nutcracker.
Statue of a lady with a clock where her stomach ought to be.
Simulated alligator wallet.
A calendar book. My insurance man.
Green polka dot pajamas
and a Japanese transistor radio. Merry Christmas, everybody!
You're listening to Alan Sherman, Part 2. Our interview with Mark Hoehn, the author of Overweight Sensation. Let's get back to our recorded interview.
So this is what drove Sherman to do what he did with these first two albums. By the third album, with My Son, The Nut, which had Hello Mudda, Hello Fada on it.
Oh, that's Hello Mudda, Hello Fada was on the third album.
Yes, My Son, The Nut. That album is a much more pop culture American album. There's almost nothing on it of explicitly Jewish content. He had more or less done everything he wanted to do with his first two albums, Jewishly. Mm-hmm. The great achievement of his third album was to expose Sherman as a great, great observer of American life, American suburban life. That's where you get Here's to the Crabgrass. That's where you get Becoming a Rabbit with Me. That's where you get Automation, about the coming of the computer revolution.
Mm-hmm.
It was automation, I know, that was what was making the factory go. It was IBM, it was UNIVAC, it was all those gears going clickety-clack, dear. I thought automation was keen, till you were replaced by a 10-ton machine. It was that computer that tore us apart, dear. Automation broke my heart. There's an RCA 503 standing next to me, dear, where you used to be. Doesn't have your smile, doesn't have your shape, just a bunch of punch cards and light bulbs and tape, dear. You're a girl who's soft, warm, and sweet, but you're only human, and that's obsolete. Though I'm very fond of that new 503. Here, automation's not for me. It was automation, I'm told. That's how I got fired, and I'm out in the cold. How could I have known when the 503 started into blink? It was winking at me. I thought it was just some mishap when it sidled over and sat on my lap. But when it said, I love you, and gave me a hug, dear, that's when I pulled out its plug.
Once were the best bunny at the Playboy Club. You're getting to be a rabbit with me. I just sit there and stare as you hop from shrub to shrub. You're getting to be a rabbit with me. When I proposed to you that evening last spring, you said you'd be my mate. So I went out and bought a 2-carat ring, and both of them you ate. Then your ears grew an inch, and your nose began to twitch, and I noticed your tail was attached permanently. So I keep you in the backyard in a wooden hutch, 'cause you're getting to be a little too much like Bugs Bunny. You're getting to be a rabbit with me. I feel like something's switching, it's all so strange and new. Egad, my nose is twitching, I'm a rabbit too. I'm getting to be a rabbit, hippity hop, I love you. I'm getting to be a rabbit like you. Move over, honey, and pass the lettuce.
This is Tom Savino. You're listening to Savino Veritas, and you're listening to Alan Sherman Part 2, with our interview as well with Mark Cohen, who wrote Overweight Sensation, a biography of Alan Sherman. So let's get back to Mark Cohen.
But my Son the Nut is filled with really terrific songs. It's a terrific album. And those three albums in 10 months, October 62, December 62, August 63, three albums in 10 months, is an extraordinary record of comic achievement. And in fact, it was only a year or two ago that Sherman was back in the news when one of Al Yankovic's albums became the number one album in the country. And it was the first time in a little more than 50 years since Alan Sherman's My Son the Nut that a comedy album hit number one on the charts. Sherman's name was in the news not long ago because Yankovic's album at number one recalled the fact that it was the first time in half a century since that happened, and the last person to do it was Sherman.
So he's kind of the Babe Ruth of comedy parodies, and Yankovic is a newcomer, more or less, compared
yes,
to that.
Yes, and Yankovic loves Sherman, and Yankovic gave me a wonderful blurb for the book. He's very open about his debt to Sherman. And Yankovic has done a wonderful job and made apparently a much more successful life and certainly a much more successful and long-lasting career than Sherman was ever able to make for himself. Yankovic has done a really good job of running his career. Sherman did not have the emotional stability to have a long and successful life. The damage that was inflicted on him as a child was deep and long-lasting, and you know his career hit its height in the summer of 63, and he was dead in 73, 10 years later. He died of heart failure.
Heart failure, yeah.
He had long been suffering from emphysema. Emphysema was a problem for him even in college. Even in 63 or 64, I found newspaper articles where he had to be admitted to hospitals to have weight loss treatments, and he needed oxygen to breathe properly. His health, and this is a man of 37, 38, 39, 40 years old, a young man, right?
Yes.
He was already in need of hospitalization, and not because he had been struck down with unforeseen and unavoidable things like cancer or a stroke or something like that. These were the health problems that come from many long years of heavy smoking, heavy drinking, heavy eating.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't. He didn't show any initiative that someone would take who was determined to have a long life.
I think that comes out, too, in his song, Overweight People.
Somewhere overweight people just like me must have some place where folks don't count every calorie. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up tall, there's a land where they've never heard of cholesterol, where folks can eat just what they want and still be slim and trim and gaunt, you'll find me. Where every little thing I taste won't wind up showing on my waist, or worse, behind me. Somewhere overindulging is divine. If their waistlines aren't bulging, why then, oh, why does I?
Yes. He talks about his weight problem, not just on the unreleased overweight people, but also on My Son the Nut, his third album, Hail to the Fat Person, which is a brilliant, funny song about how he became fat.
I would like to explain how it came to pass that I got fat. Ladies and gentlemen, I got fat as a public service. When I was a child, my mother said to me, "Clean the plate because children are starving in Europe." And I might point out that that was years before the Marshall Plan was ever thought of. So I wanted to do my part for my country. So I would clean the plate 4, 5, 6 times a day, because I thought somehow that that would keep the children from starving in Europe. But I was wrong. They kept starving and I got fat. So I would like to say to all of you out there who are either skinny or in some other way normal, when you walk home or you're walking on the street and you see a fat person, do not scoff at that fat person. Oh no. Take off your hat and hold it over your heart. And in a proud, happy voice, look at him and say, "Hail to thee, fat person. You kept us out of war."
It's not the true story about how he became fat. It's a cliched version of the doting Jewish mother urging him to eat. That wasn't his mother. He didn't have that kind of mother. He had that kind of grandmother.
Yeah.
And it's certainly apparent that during his time living with his grandmother, he became familiar with the classic and eventually stereotypical Jewish American home life and values and style of eating and living, with the focus on food and health and eating and getting enough to eat. Sherman experienced that at his grandmother's home, and he loved his grandmother dearly and strongly. And it seems pretty clear that it was there that food and love became synonymous. And that eating was a way of loving himself. Ironically, it was also his way of killing himself.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a complex fella. He was a complex fella, very bright, very creative, funny, loved to entertain, but a number of people who knew him wrote that he was one of the most self-destructive people he had ever met. He chain-smoked, and he would hack and cough violently And people would say, what are you doing, Alan? He said, don't worry, it'll be okay. It'll be all right. That was a common refrain with him. It'll be all right. It's good. It's fine. Don't worry about it. It wasn't all right. But
that's pretty young, 49.
Yeah, it is pretty young. Although, you know, in the early to mid-60s and early 70s, a lot of men were dying young. When I was looking for people to interview who were his contemporaries, I discovered often that so-and-so died years ago when they were 50 or 57. You know, the Mad Men era that we all started to become at least superficially familiar with through the show, the television show, was a time where people drank a lot, smoked a lot. Exercise was not a thing that a lot of people did. Medical attention to these problems was not what it is today. And a lot of guys dropped dead in their offices of heart attacks in their 40s and 50s. It was not unusual. It was not that unusual. So certainly...
Yeah, I guess that was sort of the beginning of the awareness of what that kind of lifestyle does to us.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, in the mid-60s, I mean, doctors were smoking. You know, it was... I mean, there was an awareness, certainly, among people who strove to make themselves aware. But smoking, a lot of eating, drinking, that was common. Getting heavy was not a problem. There was a wonderful joke in an Alan King book, Help, I'm a Prisoner in a Chinese Bakery, which appeared more or less exactly around the time of Sherman's fame in the early 60s, where he's talking about President Kennedy's Get Fit America program. I'm not sure it went under that name. And he said, and he mocked it. Alan King was mocking it. You know, he said Kennedy's saying to America, America's getting soft. And King's response was, hey, Mr. Kennedy, I don't want a hard Jane Mansfield. You know, like, you know, all that lovely voluptuousness of Jane Mansfield, he grouped that all together with the idea of getting fit, which made getting fit, you know, like a bad idea. But even then, people saw that what Sherman was doing was out of bounds.
Oh, yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Out of bounds.
Mark, can you talk a little bit about his musical background? Because when I listened to these songs last night, which I said about a dozen or more, I was really taken with the musical accompaniment was really great.
Alan Sherman's musical abilities were very limited. He had no grounding in playing an instrument. He couldn't read music. He was not a musician. However, he had been a close student of song and music for decades and decades. He loved popular song. He loved the musical theater. He loved to study how wordplay was accomplished in good lyrics, how it worked with music. This was a fascination of his, and he took it very seriously. But he needed a musician to come along and create the arrangements, to create the musical comedy that accompanied his lyric comedy. So when he had the music contract with Warner Brother Records, Warner Brothers assigned Lou Busch, who was a well-known musical arranger who had worked with Nat King Cole and others, was a real pro, to create the arrangements, hire the musicians, and take charge of that side of the recording. So it was a wonderful comic union of the professionalism of Busch, who understood that the music had to be over the top in its lushness and beauty, in order to create the mockery and set the mockery of Sherman's lyrics in proper context, to make the whole thing wonderfully ridiculous and comic.
I know a man named Otis who invented a room, and his heart was filled with pride. I said to Mr. Otis, what does your room do? He said it goes from side to side. So I said, Mr. Otis, if you take my advice, you'll be the richest man in town. You gotta take that room that goes from side to side and make it go up and down.
And that was good advice, good advice. Good advice costs nothing and it's worth the price.
I sincerely doubt that the world could do without my good advice. Sir Isaac Newton came around to my house one day. His face was all sunburned and red. He said he didn't want to sleep in the shade of a tree because an apple might fall on his head. I said, Sir Isaac, you dumbbell, take my advice. Go right back there and sleep beneath that tree. And if you let that rotten apple fall down on your head, why, you'll discover gravity.
And that was good advice, good advice. Good advice costs nothing and it's worth the price. The world's a better place since I gave the human race my good advice.
A man named Mr. Waterman invented a tube. He was sad because it sprung a little leak. He said, darn it, when I hold my tube on a piece of paper, the ink leaks out and makes a little streak. He said, I've got to find a way to stop that leak. I'll start working on my leak-proof tube again. I said, Waterman, you idiot, don't stop that leak. You just invented a fountain pen.
And that was good advice, good advice. Good advice costs nothing and it's worth the price.
I'm so worldly wise, I should get the Nobel Prize for good advice. Good old Henry Ford, he was a hard-working man. He worked all night and all day. I said, Henry, what you doing? And Henry, he said, I'm inventing the Chevrolet. He said, I've already built 25 models, one for each letter from A to Z. I said, Henry, you fool, there are 26 letters in the alphabet. He said, good heavens, I forgot the Model T.
And that was good advice, good advice. Good advice was nothing and it's worth the price.
It's a little as can be and it's absolutely free, my good advice. Wilbur and Orville were two brothers named Wright, the nicest pair of kids you've ever seen. They worked 12 years on a secret project. They thought it was a washing machine. I said, fellas, what are all those wings for? They said, for hanging clothes out to dry. I said, you fools, take that washing machine out to Kitty Hawk and see if the darn thing will fly.
And that was good advice. Good advice. Good advice costs nothing and it's worth the price.
I'm so smart that I'm gonna win a Guggenheim for good. Benjamin Franklin was a charming old man. He was always flying his kite. One night I said, Benji, why ain't you out with your kite? He said, because it's raining tonight. I said, Benji, sweetie, you go right back out there and to your kite string, tie a key. There's
this may shock you, Benji, my boy, but that's electricity.
And that was
good advice. Good advice. Good advice costs nothing and it's worth the price. I'll remodel you if you'll only listen to my good advice. Oogamagook was a Neanderthal man, a very poorly educated soul. He had a great big square thing made of solid stone, and in the middle of it was a hole. One day he had to go from his cave in Natchez to his uncle's cave in Mobile. I said, round off those corners and buy a set of tires. And ookie, baby, that's a wheel.
And that was good advice.
Good advice. Good advice costs nothing and it's worth the price. Harvard offered me a Phi Beta Kappa key for good advice. Sigmund Freud, he had an unfurnished house. He was a very nosy fellow, so it seems. He had no chair, so he made all his friends stand around all day and tell him all their secrets and their dreams. Well, they stood there talking till they got fallen arches. They yelled, my feet are killing me. Ouch! I said, Sigmund, don't you realize you've got a gold mine here? Go out and buy yourself a leather couch. Every word you're told will be 18 karat gold. That's
good advice.
Alexander Graham Bell was building a fence with some wood and a long piece of wire. He said, there's something strange going on around here. I keep hearing the voice of Uncle Meyer. I said, Mr. Graham Cracker, that was my little joke. With that wire, you got the world in your power. Just get a mouthpiece and an earpiece and a piece in between, and you'll sponsor the telephone hour.
Good advice. Good advice.
Good advice costs nothing and it's worth the price. Every word you hear is the message of the year. It's good advice. Christopher Columbus was a seaman second class when I told him that the Indies could be found by sailing to the west instead of sailing to the east. I advised him that I thought the world was round. I really thought so. And then I sent him down to ask good Queen Isabel to pawn her jewels for all their worth. Next day he set sail, and as everyone knows, he fell off the edge of the earth.
Just the same as good advice.
Everybody makes occasional mistakes, and that was bad.
So it worked. The partnership between the two worked wonderfully well.
Wanted to get some new girlfriends, so I went and bought a Mercedes Benz. A waste of money, $8,000 down the drain. I thought the girls would get wild and reckless, so I bought cultured pearls and a diamond necklace. A waste of money that cost me 4,000 more. They were returned. I got no girls they repossessed. Both the car and the pearls.
I styled my hair just like Cary Grant's. Bought a pair of those new tight pants. A waste of money. Household finance took my pants. The female gender, I just don't get it. Just when I'm out of both cash and credit, I found a honey. And this is what's funny. She don't need my money. She works for household finance.
Was Alan Sherman a success or a failure? Because the last 8 years of his life, from 65 to 73, were really tough. His marriage was over. His career came to an end. His health deteriorated. It was really bad. But Sherman achieved something that very few people in their lives ever achieve, and that was to succeed in the field they imagined for themselves as a child. One of the things I was able to find was Sherman's very first song parody, written when he was in junior high school at John Burroughs Junior High School in Los Angeles. In the student newspaper of the junior high school, Alan wrote a song parody of the Mother Goose nursery rhyme, "Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall." Sherman wrote, "Humpty Dumpty sat on a train, happily singing, Benir Bistu Shane," which was the great song that the Andrews sisters had sung and made into a number one hit.
Yes.
Benir Bistu Shane, da-da-da-da-da. Well, I realized that in those two lines, Sherman, at 13 years of age, imagined his entire future and understood deeply his own predicament. He was already a overweight, rotund, damaged Humpty Dumpty who could be made happy singing Jewish songs. Humpty Dumpty sat on a train, happily singing Benir Bistu Shane.
Thank you, Mark Hone, author of Overweight Sensation, the story of Alan Sherman. And we'll end tonight not with the usual Savino Veritas theme song, but with an Alan Sherman song, Downtown.
I believe it's about people, and I believe it's about the eternal war that goes on between children and parents.
Mommy and Dad are never nervous or mad when you teenagers go downtown. Daddy and Mom just stay at home and keep calm and watch the late, late show uptown. 'Cause when you kids are gone, we get to spend some time alone here. That's our only chance to use the bathtub or the phone here when you're away. Besides, we're stuck where we are because you kids took our money, you kids took our car and went down. Don't come home till 4 a.m. 'cause you're roaming in the street somewhere downtown. We would feel swell if only someone would tell us what goes on down there downtown. But every time we ask you what you're doing after dark there, you just say that you were fruking to Petula Clark there. That's what I mean. So kids, give your folks a break, because you're driving us crazy. We sit here all night and take pills. Following bills, so we'll calm down, counting the hours, you're down. there goes the car. Beside that, you've been arrested. So we gotta get up and we gotta get dressed and go downtown. Borrow a car and go downtown. That's where you are, you finch. Downtown. Wait till I get you kids home. There'll be no more frugging, no swimming, no jerk, no mashed potatoes, no slop. Now take some else. You're gonna stay home tomorrow night. And your mother and I are going downtown. And we're gonna dance the tango. And the clock strikes, and we're going to do the bunny hop. It's a nice dance.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end. By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.